Hello and welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. Today is World Mental Health Day, a chance for the media to look itself in the mirror and consider whether we are reporting on the topic as well as we could be. Mental health is not only a broad term, but it's also a very delicate and complex one. As a result, news reporting can often be overly simplistic or downright inaccurate. That's according to our guest today, James Scurry, senior producer at Sky News and a qualified psychotherapist. These days, a lot of mental health concepts are squeezed into a 60-second trending TikTok video that doesn't nearly give people an accurate picture of what it is or depict the latest thinking on the topic. And news doesn't do enough to hold that to account or do a better job of it themselves. It's not just the news or social media, though. Even the NHS figures on young people with mental health disorders can't be taken at face value. So we're going to chew over some of the big misconceptions, for example, around schizophrenia and depression, so you can do these important topics justice in your reporting, not just for your general news audience, but those actually living with these conditions. Don't go anywhere. James, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. A real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jacob.
James, we're going to talk a lot today about reporting on mental health topics, maybe some of the misconceptions, maybe some of the do's and don'ts, maybe some of the things that you've seen in your really interesting career to date, which, you know, you've had faith in both newsrooms as well as being a qualified psychotherapist. So talk to me about your career to date, you know, where it all started and what's led you to what you do now, if you would.
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting to go back and think about how we start. So I was actually hired midway through my degree in Melbourne in Australia as the tape boy at Channel 9 in Melbourne. So that is the person who does the VHS dubs recordings at the time to give out to the publicity teams and to send out. And I fell in love with TV. It was what I wanted to do from the very beginning of my kind of career consultations at high school. And I got midway through my TV degree at RMIT University in Melbourne and got a summertime job at Channel 9 in Melbourne, which was, you know, one of the big commercial broadcasters, and dropped out of the degree, became the tape boy, and then slowly rose through the ranks to the newsroom there. So ended up in a production role and eventually ended up going back to university. So I studied international relations and I went to Paris to work at the Australian Embassy on an internship, learned to speak French, had an amazing time and thought, right, am I going to go back to Australia and get stuck there so far away from where I felt like, you know, some of the most interesting stuff in the world was happening? I rolled the dice and took a chance on the UK. I arrived in the UK with £1,000 in my pocket and no idea what I was going to do. And after a short, brief stint folding t-shirts at Zara on Oxford Street, I managed to get into Sky News with my background from Channel 9. And so I've been at Sky News since 2009. I guess that's over 15 years now, and have done everything in that newsroom that I think it's possible to do, I think, from the satellite desk, to chief sub video editor, to the deputy foreign news editor, to producer, senior producer, assistant editor. And that's as far as I really want to climb now. And so, yeah, I trained as a psychotherapist, as you mentioned in your introduction, and have since really found a passion for helping journalists to do a better job of journalism, to hone their craft by becoming more trauma-informed in their approaches to things like interviews, and also thinking about things like language as well, when we write, what we write, the words we choose, and the power that they have when we put them out into the world. So yeah, I'm kind of in two worlds. I'm still at Sky, and I'm a practicing psychotherapist in London.
So you're juggling both still at this point in time. You know, you're freelancing on both sides?
Yeah, so I have a consultancy career, really. I'm at Sky at the weekends for my sins, I say. And I have a clinical practice in West London. I'm the co-founder of a non-profit called Safely Held Spaces, which is piloting and running training programs with kind of focus towards mental health. And we're one of the sponsors of the Media Strong Symposium, which is a big journalist mental health symposium that runs at City University, and we'll be running again at City University in 2025.
It's how we know each other, of course. Do you work exclusively with journalists in your consultancy work?
No. So actually, journalism is more of a newer area. Well, mostly my area of expertise is complex trauma and post-traumatic stress. So just to kind of define those, post-traumatic stress is, you know, something that happens to us that somehow overwhelms our nervous system, and leaves us with kind of traumatic residue in the body and the mind, which needs to be processed. Complex trauma is kind of many, more than one event. So it's kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion. So there'll be more than one traumatic event in a person's history. And as a therapist, you have to work really slowly and work through one event at a time. So my background really in that area has taken me towards veterans, military, police. So I do work in that space around everything from complex trauma to insomnia to trauma-affected sleep. And I do things like workshops, big workshops that are run online and internationally for those audiences. But what I've seen is that the work that I do with veterans and military kind of applies to anyone working on the front line. So whether you're a police officer, whether you're in the army, maybe you're a journalist in a war zone, it's really that it doesn't matter necessarily. What's key is that on a regular basis, you're having to really do quite a lot of psychological and emotional labor, but you're also having to put your body into a state of fight or flight, low level fight or flight, sometimes really high level fight or flight, releasing adrenaline and cortisol into your body, and that takes its toll. It's a really exciting time to be working in the field. And I think, Jacob, journalists are really interested, actually, in looking after themselves, not just looking after themselves, but doing better journalism as well. And ultimately, this is what learning these skills is all about. It's about us honing our craft and telling better stories.
How comfortable are journalists, in your experience, talking about their mental health? You know, when you try and engage in these conversations, what's that typically like?
Yeah, so I think I would say that we're getting better. Having spoken at the Media Strong Symposium, which is organized by Leona O'Neill, who herself, a journalist, who was unfortunately caught up in an incident in Ireland where she was next to another journalist who was shot and killed. And so she developed post-traumatic stress. I don't think she'd mind me saying that because she's written a book about it.
And she spoke to us about it on our very podcast. So it's all on the record, not to worry.
So it's all on the record. Yeah. Where I think we're kind of a bit stuck is we kind of see mental health as a bit of an add-on. Like, it's nice to have the kind of mental health first aid workers in the newsroom. It's nice to have the phone line where you call if you get into a crisis, but all of that is really geared towards what happens once you're actually in a crisis. Whereas the work that I've been doing with City University, the work that I've been doing kind of clinically, shows me and sort of is helping me to understand that we don't need to wait till people get into a crisis in the first place. We can actually put things in place and make it part of the way in which newsrooms function. So I'll give you an example. As a psychotherapist, I work with pretty intense stories and I work with pretty intense presentations in my therapy room. Now, for every 4 hours of clinical work that I do, I need to go and have an hour of supervision. And this is kind of pretty standard across the psychotherapeutic world, counselors, and in many professions, I would say that there is this idea of supervision. Now, when I go into an edit suite in a newsroom, often I see material that's much more distressing, much more traumatic than I hear about in my clinical practice. And yet there is no supervision. And the way I would use a metaphor to describe that is, in my clinical practice, I have a cup that fills up. And when my trauma cup is filled up, I get to go and tip it out with a supervisor who helps me to process those emotions so they don't stay with me. In the newsroom, we don't currently have a process for preemptively or in a preventative way, trying to allow journalists, giving journalists the space to tip out that trauma cup. Mental health is kind of seen as a nice to have, but it's not fully integrated into the newsroom setting and into the craft of journalism. And this is why I always say, I think what we're looking at now is not a problem. Mental health in journalism is not a problem we're trying to solve. It's an opportunity we haven't yet embraced. It's an opportunity we haven't yet discovered. So I'm excited about this work because I think it's going to help us to tell better stories and to be better journalists, which is the reason why most of us are doing the roles that we do. We want to tell good stories.
So James just said that mental health is an opportunity we haven't yet embraced or discovered. Well, you're in luck. One great opportunity to start with comes at our next journalism conference, News Rewired, on the 27th of November at Number 6 in London. James is leading a workshop with Lisa Archibald, co-director of the Intentional Peer Support Network, and they will both show you how this innovative framework can help journalists consistently manage their mental health rather than accessing support only when they reach breaking point. James sums it up best here.
My passion is really the preventative. My passion is really like, how can people not get to mental health crises in the first place? I have had mental health crises myself, working in the news industry, and they were deeply, deeply unpleasant, amongst the probably more difficult experiences of my life. And so I do have a kind of dog in the fight here. I don't want anyone else to go through the things that I've gone through. And so for me, preventing the crisis is absolutely key.
For the full agenda and to secure your place today, head over to newsrewired.com and we'll see you there. Now let's get back to the interview. How do the demands and pace of newsrooms affect our precision, accuracy, quality of reporting on mental health, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Jacob, and it's an area I feel so passionately about. I think that staff in newsrooms are really trying to kind of do more and more and more with less, or perhaps the same amounts. I can see the fabric trying to be stretched a little bit further to cut our cloth accordingly. And one of the problems with that is I think that across the whole industry, we don't have a lot of time to do things. And so there's that kind of idea of journalism where we're trying to get things out very quickly. Things like the chief sub-editor, for example, you know, the person checking the quality, the person checking the language, the person checking the style guide. I see some of that across the industry, the sort of sliding. We are speeding up to some degree, trying to keep up with the clicks. But a lot of what I see out there getting the most clicks is the worst coverage.
Well, give us some examples of where that nuance is lost, if you would.
I mean, so I'll give you two examples, maybe one from a newspaper and one from social media. I mean, like things like, you know, are you a narcissist videos on TikTok that go into like, you know, or are you a sociopath? Or have you been dating a sociopath? I mean, they're kind of designed to demonize basically people who have experienced extreme trauma. So a person who presents as a narcissist or a person who presents as a sociopath doesn't have access to empathy. They don't have access to empathy because when they were very little, every time they showed it, their psychological defenses were obliterated by someone very damaging. And so you can't meet a narcissist or a sociopath or someone who doesn't have the very, very worst complex trauma history. And so I think that these videos are very unhelpful because they basically other people who are very hurt and they turn them into labels. The other area was a big newspaper recently published a headline on schizophrenia, which, you know, I sent around the industry, and it was really deeply damaging. There was no mention of trauma in the entire article, and it was a very well-regarded global newspaper who was very interested in focusing on the treatment of schizophrenia, but hadn't mentioned any of the kind of thinking on the presentation of what we call voice hearing, probably over the last 50 years. And I had the chief executive of Mind contacted me, the chief executive for the Center for Mental Health, some of the best people working with people with a presentation of schizophrenia contacted me and said, this article is taking us back. And I wrote a letter to the editors of this publication and we received no response. And the offer was really not to criticize, but to go in and help, to say, hey, we run you know, training programs, which could help you guys editorially. And, you know, I heard on the grapevine that they were happy with their coverage. And I just was really quite gobsmacked by their lack of curiosity.
Let me take those two examples separately for a moment, if I can. The first one on, am I a narcissist? You're referring to posts, not necessarily by news publishers, but that might appear on social media. These are like trending posts at the moment, right?
Yeah. So like, you know, TikTok, this is content creation side of things, influencers. It's what generates clicks. These, and I should say, by the way, that these videos are getting huge audiences, you know, somewhere upwards of 10, 20 million clicks sometimes for a video. And what I'm worried about is that they're presenting complex clinical ideas in a way that's really designed to kind of, to make this a very binary conversation. Here is a narcissist. They're an evil person. Here's what you need to do to, you know, avoid being hurt by them.
And but it is an enormous challenge, isn't it, James, in terms of making space for nuance in a really compressed content medium, right? I mean, we can do the greatest long-form journalism, but there's also a question of whether people really truly engage with that journalism when there is such an overwhelming tide and narrative sort of going against the reporting on social media.
So I've got a few things to say on that. You know, if we're going to put together a 2.5-minute video that's threadbare and doesn't really tell the story, then I think, why bother? Like, why do journalism that's not accurate? Why do journalism that's really only putting across a simplistic message? One way to combat that I feel could work is that there's an offering for a short piece of content which links to a larger piece of content. And I think that's actually a really good way of doing it. And I just think, Jacob, isn't it interesting that anyone who's been a journalist in a newsroom will know that you can do a 10 to 20 minute interview sometimes and know when you're doing it, you're only going to be using 15 seconds to 20 seconds in a soundbite. Now, so my question is, why are we not trusting that, you know, there is an audience for good quality journalism? Some of the best newspapers in the world who've decided to use paywalls do amazing journalism. They do in-depth journalism. They do long-form journalism and people will pay for it. So I do think we're cutting our nose off to spite our face and kind of just colluding with this idea that everything has to be short. Why do we not think about being a bit more nuanced in our strategies where we also include an option for people who do want to understand the topic in more depth?
Yeah. Well, these are, of course, entrenched media habits for social media users. But what I would say, James, is that what I've heard so far is that, you know, news organizations need to hold themselves to a better standard than what is prevailing on succeeding on social media, where there are things like, you know, the, you know, Am I a Narcissist video. And so it's very disappointing when we see the headlines like that, which you referred to earlier, the newspaper and the lack of nuance when reporting on schizophrenia. So talk to me about that example for a moment. What are the ramifications in terms of getting a headline like that wrong? What's the follow-on? What's the knock-on?
Well, the knock-on, I guess, is that a person in this particular example, I won't go into the headlines. I don't want to kind of name the newspaper, but, you know, essentially what they were doing and what the concern was with those of us who work with people with that presentation is they were telling those people that they were very, very sick and that it was a very untreatable illness, and that it was, you know, something akin to some of the worst types of illnesses that people can have. Now, there's just no evidence to support any of that. You know, I think people who hear voices or have often gone through very, very difficult traumatic experiences, the actual science behind it, the best thinking behind it that I've heard, and there's many different ways of approaching voice hearing. And of course, it's also important to say that not everyone who hears voices would qualify for a diagnosis of schizophrenia. But the very best evidence that I've heard is that what happens when somebody develops a presentation of voice hearing is that the trauma is so great within them that the person's sense of self splits. And that when that split takes place, each voice becomes a part of that person's story. So a very aggressive voice might be holding the trauma from the abuser. A very friendly and kind voice might be that person's sense of goodness and sense of self, which is struggling to come to the surface and struggling to be heard. You know, a very shy voice might be that person's kind of inner wisdom that was struggling to have their voice heard. So the mind is infinitely more complicated and I would say beautiful than we allow. And the key thing with that voice hearing diagnosis of schizophrenia presentation is that in the voices is the answer to the person's story. Now, if we tell that person that their voices are meaningless, just an illness waiting to be treated and or a damaging thing that's going to lead them to live a life of misery, then we rob them of hope. And to rob someone of hope is one of the worst things that you can do to a person who's, you know, struggling with their mental health. And I get told that time and time again by the people I work with. Now, to have, you know, something as egregious and damaging as that, published in a global newspaper with no qualification and nothing trauma-informed in the article whatsoever, was deeply disappointing and it set us back years. And the worst part was, unfortunately, the journalist just had absolutely no idea about all of the thinking and all of the great work that had been done in this field over the last 50 years. And maybe the journalist was rushed, I don't know, but it's not okay. It's not okay for the journalism to not be done.
And if the journalism isn't done, then the article shouldn't be printed. And this was probably one of the most disappointing pieces that I think I've seen in my career in terms of how much it set us back. And to have the newspaper not engage at all and want to know why was upsetting. Upsetting and disappointing. And disappointing because they're not going to know why we thought it was so bad. And it's probably going to happen again.
So what have we learned so far? It is easy for complex mental health issues to be misunderstood, hence why a lot of myths and assumptions persist. But news must challenge these ideas, not accept them blindly. News organisations must be open to the idea that they may not have all the expertise to do this. As shockingly, James tells us next that most newsrooms are between 8 to 10 years behind the curve of the newest thinking on mental health. Organisations like Safely Held Spaces, The Self-Investigation, Headlines Network, to name just a few, are great resources and communities to improve both mental health in the news and the newsroom. Remember that news organisations have a lot of influence and exposure, and they should not underestimate the damage they could be doing, particularly to those living with the very conditions that is being reported on. The big question left is how to grow from the failures of reporting on mental health.
If you're going to start to talk about these very complex areas of mental health, then you need to understand the current thinking that's taking place in the field. I don't think there's any term in the mental health field that is more complex and more contested than the word schizophrenia. I think when you look at that and you take a deep dive into the literature around that area, you cannot write a piece on schizophrenia and voice hearing. And I use those two terms separately for a good reason, because for some people, they find the word schizophrenia helpful. And for others, they see it as like a spell that's been cast on them that they need to try and break. And they prefer to be known as someone who hears voices. So even just to understand that distinction in language, even to understand that, you know, telling someone they're a schizophrenic is a deeply, deeply political position in mental health. To not know that that's the case when you write the piece, I think is... yeah, it's going to take you down an outdated path.
You said something really, really revealing there, James, and you used the term current thinking when talking about mental health. I do just wonder, and I think this would be helpful to really just state clearly, is how quickly does the literature and research around mental health change, and you know, how far does it, you know, come in a short space of time? Because you touched there about, you know, reporting being outdated. Is that something you think is underestimated in newsrooms?
Yeah, I mean, I always find we're on somewhere between an 8 to 10 year, what I would call satellite delay, unfortunately. So for example, some of the challenges around the idea that depression is the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain, they were put forth by British psychiatrists sort of around about the 2015 mark. There was stuff being written about that. And I was flagging this, you know, in some of the places that I was working. And we eventually did get that story. That story did go viral and did go global when a paper was published in 2022. And so we were able to sort of unpick some of that outdated and, I guess, overly simplistic thinking in 2022 that depression is the result of, you know, a serotonin deficiency or a chemical imbalance. And that, just to kind of remind you, there are many, many, many neurotransmitters in our body. And to think that, you know, something as complex as the word depression, which describes such a panoply of different experiences, could be the result of just one of those neurotransmitters, is to me so obviously simplistic and doesn't really look at perhaps the person's story. And, you know, where our experiences of the world are mediated by our biology. So our biology plays a part. But I think unless you look at things from a psychosocial, biological, and I would even say maybe ecological point of view these days.
But you said that news reporting is 10 years behind the current literature on mental health.
In mental health, I think 8 to 10 years sometimes, because some of what I see being reported on just doesn't gain traction. Another one that I think is really important is, you know, and I bring up antidepressants with slight reticence, because the first thing I want to say is I have no problem with medication. And in fact, I've used it at times in my history as well. So I just want to sort of preface what I'm going to say next with that first. But that chemical imbalance language is still in leaflets, in antidepressants around the world, which is so shocking, I think, given that, you know, it's such tenuous evidence that it's based upon. And I've just been waiting for a news organization to get onto that story, like to hold these pharmaceutical companies to greater account on their science, I think. Because if you're going to tell someone that there's a serotonin deficiency in their brain, surely you need to do a test to test and measure the serotonin. And I think that is unfortunately one of the lines that's still parroted by, you know, GPs and mental health professionals, albeit, you know, in the best, with the best of intentions. And this is where we get stuck because it's an assumed knowledge. So a journalist might just reach for something like, well, it's an imbalance. And that word imbalance is just so fraught with complication.
As someone who knows both worlds of the newsroom and the, you know, the psychotherapy world, is there any other editorial decisions in your career that you look back now with the hindsight of your training and your qualifications that you look back and think, you know, that wasn't right. We didn't get that right.
Mm.
Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, there is. So the one that really bugs me comes out every couple of years is when NHS Digital puts out a press release and tells us how many young people have mental health disorders in the country. And I've talked about this in talks that I've given. You know, the problem that I have with that is that every year it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So I think if we go back to sort of the 2018 statistics, it was 1 in 8 or something young people has a mental health disorder. And then by the time we got to sort of, I think 2022 might have been the last ones, it was 1 in 4 young people had a mental health disorder. So the problem that I have with that is twofold. One is that we're kind of medicalizing everything now to the point where we're only seeing the difficulties and the distress that young people are seeing as a diagnostic label. And what one of my great friends, who's a clinical psychologist, says is that young people are a barometer of our society. And so if we're just telling them that they're sick and we're telling them that they belong on a clinical waiting list, we're not actually looking at the underlying reasons why they're feeling that way in the first place. And so when those NHS Digital press releases come out, and the next one, I guess, will be saying 1 in 2 because they've been progressively getting worse and worse. When they come out and they language everything through that prism of the disorder, what I see happening is a whole bunch of press around what's wrong and absolutely no coverage around what happened. Why do they feel the way they do? To me, it just seems like a baffling lack of curiosity as to why young people might all of a sudden be feeling more and more distressed. We need to really be careful with that type of language, and we need to ask other questions. The other thing I would say is that often those press releases are just written up and put out in articles. So very, very, actually, I don't ever think I've seen anyone interview a psychologist and ask a psychologist, a psychotherapist, anyone working in the field, do you think 1 in 4 people in the country, I mean, it's a big thing to say, Jacob, 1 in 4 people in the country is mentally unwell. What I would say is that I do believe that 1 in 4 people in the country is feeling deeply mentally and emotionally distressed. Whether or not I would language that as them having a pathology inside them that needs treatment, I don't know. A lot of what I see in my clinical practice is people responding in a completely understandable way to a society that's increasingly losing its way. That's what I see. I see sanity in these young people. I don't see pathology.
Right. I hear you on that, James, I really do. And, you know, we're fast approaching time here, so I want to get to a question I think is really important, which is, earlier on, you mentioned that you don't like days like World Mental Health Day. And I wonder if the reason for that is that, you know, there's newsrooms are going to be flocking towards this and going to be writing up press releases. And, you know, it's a moment for a click and it's, you know, a moment in time. I guess my question is, how do you take more care in a moment when there's going to be this big frenzy of attention on something as delicate and sensitive and nuanced and complex as mental health?
Yeah, I think we need to do a bit more work as journalists across the entire field in even understanding this whole word mental health, because I think it's so easy sometimes for us to go, okay, yeah, let's just get someone on with, you know, a presentation of depression, or let's get someone on who's, you know, had a very difficult story. And what we're often doing is we're kind of reaching for the obvious, I guess, and we're not really asking the harder questions that most people in the mental health field, most people that work in the mental health field would want us to talk about. So instead of just talking about happy stories, you know, on World Mental Health Day, can we talk about the recent abuse that's happened in Manchester and Essex on psychiatric wards, where staff have been, you know, accused of detaining, locking people up, of forcibly medicating them? Can we talk about the outdated guidance that's on the NHS website with regards to chemical imbalances? Can we talk about the concomitant literature in antidepressant boxes that is also completely out of date? Can we talk about the Mental Health Act, which hasn't been reformed in a very long time. And it's really, and this is not just me saying this, the research has been done, it's completely unfit for purpose. One of the statistics that's often cited is that since the 1980s, £500 billion has been spent on mental health, and yet it's the only area of medicine, the only area where at best outcomes have stalled, and by the worst measure, they're even going backwards. So why are we not talking about, you know, the more poignant, the more relevant discussions, rather than turning it into some kind of fluffy, just before the weather type segments? I think mental health is not just about the field of working with people's psychological and emotional distress. Mental health is, we silo it. It's actually relevant to everything. You know, if you only have to look at our politics and the people that, you know, were previously in power to see what trauma looks like. And I really mean that, like to see what trauma, when it's not dealt with properly, can look like. You can have the wrong types of people in positions of power who haven't done their emotional work, who are short-sighted and doing things for publicity and for their own kind of ego and validation, and not actually thinking about how do we actually want to design policies that are really going to help people. So, you know, I do carefully walk into politics there, but I do think if you ask any mental health professional, do they think there is trauma present in politicians in the way that they work? I think all of them would agree that mental health is not just an area that's limited to the area of psychology, you know, and the work that I do. Mental health is something that needs to be understood across many fields. And so to answer your question, I think Mental Health Awareness Day, what is it that we want to be aware of? Because I think sometimes we can't see the wood from the trees, really.
Love it, James. I can just feel your passion and your power coming through this podcast right now. I think there's some really, really helpful and practical insights there for our audience. So I'm going to thank you very much for speaking with me today. And it's been a real blast to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jacob.
If I take one thing from today, it's this. Be curious about mental health and be committed to improving how we report on it. For your next story about mental health, whether it's a day like Mental Health Day or just another Tuesday, who is your story serving? Is it based on the latest literature in the field? Have you spoken to a proper, active professional? Is the latest TikTok trend providing enough nuance to a complex topic? And can I unpick it? Asking these simple questions and more can maybe give you a different, better, or deeper story. What did you learn? Let's continue the conversation. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter/X@JPGJournalism, or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our podcast episodes on all your usual platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.